In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
I am far from an expert when it comes to country music, and I would have told you that even before I realized just how little I know about it. And I don't hate country. I listen to it and I love some country artists. But I also have, or had, I guess, a very specific image in my mind of what country music is. I would bet that most of you have that image too. And that shouldn't be surprising. That's just how the music has been promoted and sold for decades. But it wasn't how the music was born. And it's not representative of the artists who make it today either, and it's only recently that we've started to notice that. So what is the real history of country music? Where did that image in our minds that I mentioned come from? What don't we know about a genre that seems pretty easy to define? Well, a lot, as it turns out. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Elamin Abdelmahmoud is the news curation editor at BuzzFeed. He also can be found writing about country music in Rolling Stone. Hello, Elamin.
Hey, man. How's it going?
It's going really well, thanks. And I found your piece, as somebody who listened to a lot of country music in my youth, really eye-opening.
I'm so glad. That's a wonderful reaction to hear.
Why don't you start by just telling me how you fell in love with country music?
Right. Well, I didn't work my way to country for some time. Like, it's really like in the last maybe 4 or 5 years or so that I became a country person. I think I was one of those people who, you know, when people are like, "Hey, what do you listen to?" I often said like everything but country, which is like a thing that is very commonly said. Mm-hmm. And I took I guess like a circuitous route. I listened to Tom Waits. I love Tom Waits. Really important to me. And then through that I got into folk. Through that I got into Americana. And I think probably the first album that was at least significantly country was the Byrds' Sweetheart of the Rodeo, which is just like this beautiful country rock album.
Now, when we talk about country music, what is the basic traditional stereotype for the whole genre?
Well, you know, the thing about people who say the thing that I said, you know, the people who talk about how they listen to everything but country, my suspicion is like they're not distancing themselves from country, but about what it represents and its image, kind of. Like, no one says, "Oh, buddy, no, I don't listen to ska. That is not my values." But for some reason with country, like there's this sort of comfort distancing yourself from like this idea of country. And I think it's because there's this popular opinion that who listens to country and who makes it evokes this image of poor, uneducated white people. And sometimes there's like an association with, you know, unsavory attitudes that come with that image. It's like, you know, racism can only be found in country music fans and poor, uneducated white people, which is, of course, not true at all. But there is this idea that country is a domain of white people, of white artists, and particularly like working class, you know, poor white people.
Now, this is the fascinating part, is explain to me where that came from.
Well, it's a pretty intentional process. You know, the impression of country as this white and poor thing was developed in a few ways. And one of them, one of the artists that I talked to for this piece, Rhiannon Giddens, was telling me about how Henry Ford, for example, would hold fiddle competitions and he would intentionally exclude black people, or folk festivals where these, you know, kind of barely veiled attempts at trying to make this music appear as white, poor mountain music. But a great deal of it has to do with the artists that get recorded and the artists that don't get recorded during this very pivotal time in the recording industry. Because when you have the first country music recordings kind of in the 1920s, the race is largely used as a marketing tool. It's like, this is who to market this music to.
So tell me how that process works. And as you're doing it, tell me about Ralph Peer.
Of course. So Ralph Peer is still, you know, one of the most influential figures in music history. He was a record executive. His legacy is colossal. He recorded so many artists in so many different genres, from R&B to blues to country music. But it's the way that he came about, you know, doing all of this. And then early 1920s, he actually oversaw the recording of one of the first blues recording that's aimed specifically at a black market. In the late 1920s, you have these, what they call race records, which is to say a whole brand of records that are targeted towards a black audience, and they're beginning to take off. And so Ralph Peer goes to the South to find some talent to record. But what he finds is Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family. And the reason this is huge is because Jimmy Rogers goes on to become, you know, known as like the father of country music, which is quite a designation. And Peer, in his process, realizes quickly, even though what he found in the South was white musicians and black musicians doing the same kinds of music, and sometimes doing the same kinds of songs, like doing the exact same songs, he realizes pretty quickly that even though the songs are the same, he could package the white artists doing it differently. So he called it hillbilly music. And after calling it hillbilly music, that was that. That was a name for country music up until the Second World War. Like, he packaged that music as music to sell to white poor people, and that became his legacy. Is like, it's country itself is a tool. Like, country itself, meaning the genre, is a tool to sell more records.
What's the original origin of the genre behind the whitewashing? What was going on in the South before Ralph Peer came down and discovered this?
Well, so you have country music itself is this amazing marriage of the fiddle and the banjo and the guitar, but that the music was being combined by black artists, by black string bands, and by lots of white artists who were learning from them. And it's important to note that, like, at the turn of the 20th century, about half of the string bands are black. But by the time you get to the 30s, you have Ralph Peer sort of focused on recording all of these white artists, and you have almost complete erasure of this, you know, black string band history just by the sheer fact of what gets recorded and what gets remembered. Because over about a 20 to 30 year period, by focusing on the white artists who are making this music in order to sell it to white audiences, at the very early history of just recorded music period, you have this idea that these are the people who have been making this music all along, when in fact they were just learning, you know, from black string bands.
I want to ask you about, because you touched on it briefly with Jimmy Rogers, about the faces of country music. Because, you know, again, as I mentioned off the top, I'm somebody who grew up with that impression of country music that you described. And for me, you know, country began with the Carter family. And you said in your piece that, you know, you probably know the Carter family as some of the fathers of the genre. But that this piece might be the first time I'd read the name Leslie Riddle, and you were right. So tell me, who was he?
Right. To explain the significance of Leslie Riddle, I think we have to, you know, talk about the Carter family's massive generational legacy. I mean,
yeah,
they are, you know, so influential. They are among, you know, they're definitely in the pantheon of country music. And June Carter Cash is, of course, a member of the Carter family, like the band and also the family. So they have this prominent place in country history. But the thing is, A.P. Carter, who led the band, God bless his heart, couldn't write music. So all the incredible gospel music that they performed, A.P. would go to churches to collect it. And he took Leslie Riddle, a black man, with him. And Leslie would memorize the melodies while AP wrote down the lyrics. So you have, you know, this massive catalog that gets recorded by the Carters that wouldn't be possible without Riddle, who himself was an incredible musician, and who could take AP to black churches so they could gather those songs as well. And then while AP was writing down the lyrics, Leslie would memorize all the melodies and then recount them back to AP so that the Carter family could then record them.
How does that perception of country music become so ingrained as the decades go on? And I mean, I'm going to ask the question why as well, but I can suspect that the answer is obvious.
Well, I mean, the legacy of radio to country music is massive, the genre was advanced through the Grand Ole Opry. It's still to this day, this genre that relies very heavily on radio in order to get big. I think radio has an outsized influence on country in a way that it doesn't actually affect other genres right now. So the artists that radio begins to play and recognize end up being these white artists who are getting recorded and everybody else is getting forgotten. So over a pretty short period of time, you have the cementing of this idea that it's mostly white artists who do country music. This has actually never been true. You know, for pretty much every period of country, there was a deeply influential black artist in it. We were there at the founding. You know, there was Dee Ford Bailey, who was the first black performer on to play the Grand Ole Opry. And then, like, you can go through every decade from there on to discover a deeply influential black artist, whether it's Ray Charles, who put out Modern Sounds in Country and Western, which is like, you know, this album is like incredibly influential in country. It's considered one of the most important records of all time. And someone who cites that record as an influence is this little Texan musician you might know as Willie Nelson. I don't know if you've heard of him or not. There's Linda Martell, who's the first black woman to play the Opry. There's this like continuously long history, but it's increasingly seen as kind of an oddity, you know, kind of like there's like this novelty that every time a black artist pops up, be like, oh, this is like a black person in country, even though we've just been there the whole time.
Why is it with country that we don't really know this history? And I say that because I think most people who really care about music and who care about rock and roll at least know, you know, the origins of the genre and how it came from black people and was co-opted by white artists. But if the story is so similar in country, why don't we know that history?
I think it's because there's a romance with this sort of narrative of country as, I mean, like the quote that keeps being bandied about is that it's the white man's blues. It is the same way that those folk festivals were important in creation of the idea of a white ethnicity, country kind of plays into that as well. Like they're sort of intimately tied, and they've been intimately tied throughout the decades. Like that narrative gets reinscribed and reinscribed. And over time, even though you see artists who could blur the boundaries between genres and have done so for decades, that commercialism, that capitalist perspective, ends up kind of reinscribing the boundaries. So like you have these artists who could fit into country, but could also very easily fit into R&B. But if they're black, you know, radio says no, you will be played on R&B stations, and you won't get any play in country radio. And you saw that happen literally last year with Old Town Road from Lil Nas X, which became, you know, like one of the biggest charting hits of all time. But at first, it began to naturally climb some country charts until the country charts put an end to it and said, this isn't country enough. And so country's always had this kind of identity crisis of like, oh, I don't know, that belongs in another category. And it's oftentimes been a pretty thinly veiled code for race.
I was going to say, it sounds like a pretty lame excuse.
Yeah.
What is going on in the country music scene right now? I mean, we've seen artists of all genres blend their sound and also wrestle with racism in the music industry. And is that happening in country?
I think country is learning to grapple with these things, but learning very slowly. And so, you know, one of the things that I get into very briefly in the article is this story about Tomato Gate, which was this incident that happened a few years ago where someone who's pretty influential in the country radio environment said, oh, like women are the tomatoes in the country radio salad, which is to say, you shouldn't have too many of them. And there was like this great uproar, but of course, country radio is very largely male. And since then, the conversation started, but there's been very little progress when it comes to having more women on the radio. Similarly, you know, there have been people throughout the decades who've written about country's black origins and the debt that it owes to black artists, but the perception hasn't really shifted. Country still hasn't made enough space for these artists to be seen as anything more than just one-offs and recurring sort of novelties. And so right now you have some amazing artists who are accomplishing amazing things. Kane Brown is one of the biggest names in country right now. And Kane is mixed race. And there's Jimmy Allen, who's doing great. There's Mickey Guyton. There's Yola, who I talked to for this piece. There's Rhiannon Giddens. There's all these names who are pushing the genre itself forward and having pretty decent chart success when it comes to it. It's just that it's not bleeding into the foundational story of what country is, you know, like they're still sort of seen as like these one-off moments.
When you talk to artists today, like Rhiannon and Yola, what do they see out there on tour? What do they want to see change in the genre? And are they seeing progress?
Well, those two artists, it's interesting. Like, I think they approach it pretty differently. Yola, who's this British black woman who's an incredibly talented artist, her approach to it is like, look, she's pretty grounded in the history of the genre, you know? And so I talked to her and she said to me, you know, whether I'm playing a jazz festival or a blues festival or a country festival, I'm pretty rooted in the fact that the history of these genres belongs to black people. And when audiences are there, like there is no blacker space. And to me, that was like a pretty remarkable, amazing thing to be sort of secure in that history. Rhiannon comes at it from a different perspective in the sense that a lot of her work has been about the history of the black experience in America. She's written stories that were inspired by slave narratives. She's written a lot of protest anthems. So for her, like she's trying to bring to life histories. It's like she's trying to actively bring to life these histories on stage. And a lot of people, she said, you know, will come up to her and be like, this is really cool. And sort of be taken by the novelty of it. And she has to return to the space of being like, no, like this is our music. This is the music that we created. And you have to sort of, you know, be grounded in that.
What about for yourself, as a black man who loves this genre? And I know you go to country shows. What's that experience like? Is it different from going to other shows?
You know, last year I went to Boots and Hearts, the country festival that will not be happening this year because of the pandemic. A very funny experience, just like in the middle of a Miranda Lambert set, somebody behind me tapped my shoulder and I turned around. It was another black man. And he was like, look, I have to give you a hug. I'm sorry. And I was like, sure, man, let's do it.
Aww.
And it was kind of like a telling episode of just like how maybe lonely it feels for black country fans who talk about country often, who want to attend country shows, who don't see as many faces there. I think like once you start to go into the history of the genre and connect it, you know, connect the thread of the past to the present, then you start to think like, oh, like the reasons why I don't feel at home in this genre are entirely manufactured. In some cases, entirely manufactured to sell more records and to tell an incorrect story about the history of white people and black people. And I think there's a power to that. There's a power to knowing, you know, you're rooted in your own history when you listen to country music.
Before you go, can you give me, first of all, but also other people who may have been raised on a whiter history of country music, a couple of places to start? Like, I'm interested in finding some artists who were, some black artists who were making country music back when I would have assumed the genre was exclusively white.
Well, I mean, like the first and biggest name that comes to mind is, of course, Charlie Pride. And Charlie Pride is sort of seen as the North Star of black people in country. And his accomplishments, honestly, like, are staggering. I think people now remember him for being that black man who was a star in country music. But like between 1969 and 1971, Pride had 8 number one songs. I don't mean 8 songs on the chart, which would be amazing on its own. He had 8 number one songs in 2 years. That is so wild to me and so impressive to me that like, I just don't understand why we don't mention him, you know, among the greats of country music, but also just like any music whatsoever. I mean, like Drake could only dream of having 8 number ones in 2 years. That's wild. And so, you know, Charlie Pride would be the starting point. Honestly, go back and check out that Ray Charles album, Modern Sounds in Country and Western, just so you can see the influence that it had. Of course, one of the biggest black country artists of the moment is Darius Rucker. And he's largely the reason why most people know the newer version of Wagon Wheel and why you hear it at every wedding. So that is Darius Rucker's fault. So take it up with him.
Add it to the list of problems that I have with Darius Rucker.
Yeah, absolutely. And check out that Yola album, man. It's just like such a beautiful, beautiful record.
Elamine, thank you so much for walking us through this. As I said, it's possibly my fault that I didn't know this, but I'm really glad to know it now.
My pleasure.
Elamine Abdelmahmoud, editor of news curation for BuzzFeed, occasional writer for Rolling Stone. That was The Big Story. If you would like more, including another episode on country music, this one hosted by Sarah Bosfeld, you can find them at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. And of course, you can find us in your favorite podcast player, Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, doesn't matter, we're there. Leave us a rating, leave us a review. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.